Diplomatic relations with Australia if Australian lawyers enter East Timor to gather evidence of alleged atrocities. The Justice Minister, Malati, said Australia has set up a corps of lawyers to enter East Timor. He added that's extraordinary arrogance, firing the latest salvo in Jakarta's war of words with its southern neighbor over the East Timor issue. The Australian branch of the International Council of Jurists has set up a database of evidence that might be used in any UN war crimes tribunal on East Timor, similar to those in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. Some 50 Australian lawyers have also volunteered to gather evidence of abuses in East Timor, where thousands are thought to have been killed by Indonesian-backed militias since the territory overwhelmingly voted for independence in the August 30th referendum. The Justice Minister also said he would defend the Indonesian military chief, General Wiranto, if he's accused of genocide. Malati said, "Wiranto is a very kind man. If he's accused, I will defend him to the death." Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, was appointed yesterday to investigate atrocities in East Timor and said she'll have specialists on the ground next week. She's to submit her report by December 31st, after which UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will give it to the UN General Assembly and the Security Council. Meanwhile, yesterday in Washington, D.C., House Subcommittee on Human Rights held a hearing where East Timorese independence rebel leader Xanana Gusmão, as well as José Ramos Horta, testified. Alan Nairn, journalist who reported daily for Democracy Now!, also flown in from Singapore after his deportation, and began naming names of people in the Pentagon who have been involved with continued military training of Indonesian soldiers. Meanwhile, in Dili, East Timor itself, foreign soldiers launched a key push into East Timor's west today, raising the specter of a confrontation with thousands of militiamen. Several hundred Australian troops from the International Force for East Timor, known as INTERFET, swept into the territory's west only hours after Britain's Gurkha soldiers fired the first shots in the UN-mandated mission. This news from Belgrade. Police seeking the arrest of an opposition politician surrounded Serbia's Operation Opposition headquarters today after security forces again battled anti-government protesters on the streets of Belgrade. Opposition sources said plainclothes police wanted to detain Ceda Jovanovic, a senior member of the Democratic Party and one of the many activists inside the offices of the Alliance for Change, opposition bloc coordinating the demonstrations. Jovanovic has played a prominent role in 10 days of rallies demanding the resignation of President Slobodan Milosevic. He's the publisher of a pamphlet called Changes, distributed to the demonstrators. The opposition's latest campaign to oust Milosevic began peacefully. On Wednesday evening, riot police charged anti-government demonstrators as they tried to march toward the Belgrade district where Milosevic works and lives. Police forcibly dispersed protesters again Thursday night, but opposition leaders vowed to press ahead with their campaign. Zoran Djindjic said, "We're going to the end this time." Djindjic is head of the Democratic Party, who himself received blows. The daughter of former Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere said he is critically ill with leukemia in a British hospital today, but denied Tanzanian government reports that he is in a coma. Nyerere led his country to independence from Britain in 1961, became president in 1962, and ruled until stepping down in 1985. Since then, he's continued to play an advisory role in Tanzanian and African affairs, most recently leading regional efforts to bring peace to Burundi, which neighbors Tanzania. Germans today hailed the award of the Nobel Prize for Literature to novelist Günter Grass as a symbolic gesture of atonement to a country that has stained the century with blood. And North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il today met the octogenarian founding chairman of South Korea's largest conglomerate in the latest sign of a thaw between the rival Koreas. North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency said the great leader Kim Jong-il, chair of the National Defense Commission, met Hyundai's group 83-year-old honorary chair Chung Ju-young and his son. And that's some of the news at this hour. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New York. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners on this, the 50th anniversary of the Chinese Revolution, perhaps one of the most significant social upheavals of this century. I can't help wondering what Chairman Mao Zedong would think of the new China if he had a chance to come back and take a look at it, but certainly we're still feeling, especially in the third world, the effects of the Chinese Revolution on social development.
That's right, no question. Meanwhile, here in Washington, while I wasn't at any hearings on China yesterday, it was very interesting yesterday afternoon to walk into the Rayburn Building and actually witness a major hearing that, believe it or not, was packed with press, so much so that I couldn't even find a line to record the event. There was Xanana Gusmao, who will probably be the founding president of a new East Timor, testifying before a congressional subcommittee, the House Committee on Human Rights. Well, we'll have more on that one tomorrow or next week. I'm actually looking at a front page picture in the Washington Post of the parade in China. Chinese tanks rolling past Tiananmen Square in Beijing during a massive parade yesterday. The display, part of a huge, elaborately planned celebration involving more than 500,000 people in Beijing. But we're going to continue with Asia today, though a different part of Asia, and that is the nuclear accident that has stunned Japan. Japanese experts said today that the nuclear chain reaction at the site of Japan's worst ever nuclear accident has halted for now, while the government said it's ashamed it happened at all. Three workers were seriously injured and at least 35 others were exposed to radiation on Wednesday at the Tokemura plant, which is about 80 miles from Tokyo, when workers apparently poured too much uranium by accident into a purification tank containing nitric acid, a mistake that reportedly caused a flash of blue light and unleashed a chain reaction tantamount to a small nuclear bomb. The three workers most seriously injured were flown by helicopter to a special treatment unit, and two of them are in critical condition. 11 more workers were exposed to radiation today as they attempted to clean up the accident at the plant. Around 300,000 people living in a 6-mile radius have been advised to stay indoors, avoid contact with rain and well water, and warn not to harvest vegetables grown in the area. The plant is owned by the Sumitomo Metal Mining Company and operated by a company which reprocesses uranium into pellets for use in nuclear power plants. It's called the JCO Company. Workers at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, meanwhile, in New Mexico, are on standby to assist the victims. And U.S. State Department officials say the accident is comparable to the Three Mile Island accident 20 years ago in Pennsylvania. The accident has once again raised concerns over the safety of nuclear plants, both in Japan and around the world. It came less than 24 hours before the arrival of a shipment of weapons-usable plutonium at the Takahama nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture, a shipment that is at the center of a scandal. The producers of the fuel, British Nuclear Fuels, known as BNFL, have admitted to falsifying important safety data during production in the Sutherfield nuclear plant in Britain. The plutonium is to be used for production of a controversial new fuel called mixed oxide fuel, and there have been people protesting that. But right now, joining us in the studio in New York is Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a nuclear physicist and professor at City College at the City University of New York, also a producer of Pacifica Program Explorations, which is a national science news magazine. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michio.
Glad to be on, Amy.
So tell us about this nuclear accident in Japan and just how significant it is.
Well, this could be the Three Mile Island of Asia. This was called a supercriticality accident. Now, there are two ways, for example, in which a car could overheat. One way, of course, is that the energy of gas of the gasoline is converted to heat, and the radiator then suffers a leak. That's called the meltdown that most people are aware of. However, there's a second accident that could happen in your car, and that is the gasoline could ignite and blow up. That is the supercriticality accident, and that's what happened at Chernobyl. Chernobyl was not a meltdown. It was a reactor supercriticality accident. Now, in the United States, we've had 7 workers blown apart and exposed to lethal quantities of radiation in this kind of supercriticality accident, 6 of them in military reactors and processing plants, and 1 in a commercial plant. Now, here, a worker poured uranium, 35 pounds worth, 7 times more than what he was supposed to, into a vat of nitric acid, which would then help to dissolve the uranium. There was a blinding blue flash of light called Cherenkov radiation. It's caused by neutrons that blow out of the chain reaction. And unfortunately, I'm very sad to say, these workers will probably die. They were hit with approximately 1,000 rads of radiation. Now, by contrast, 600 will kill you. So they received about double the fatal amount of radiation. And this is almost a textbook case. This has happened on a number of occasions in the United States, of course, not with so much other damage to the other areas. But we've had experience in the United States with these kinds of accidents. And it was a textbook accident, a very tragic accident that could be a body blow to the Japanese nuclear power industry, which maintains 51 nuclear power plants in a very small series of islands.
Well, Michio, one of the things that that we're hearing is that initially people within a 6-mile radius were told to stay in their homes, but now they're being told that it's okay to go outside. Yet Reuters is reporting that radiation levels yesterday were 15,000 times normal a mile away from the plant. Does it sound right to you that the government should be telling people that it's okay to go about their business so soon?
Well, most of the radiation was concentrated at site, where apparently 10 to 15,000 times more radiation was registered at site. The problem was that a plume of radiation came out of the site. That's different. That didn't happen in many of the U.S. accidents. And that plume of radiation is the reason why they told 300,000 people to stay indoors. Now, in a criticality accident, the burst of radiation is over in a microsecond. The lingering effects, though, is the fact that they were unable to gain access to the site. This thing was just bubbling away with radiation. They couldn't get to the site because it was so radioactive. It took them many hours before they were finally able to control the site. Now, radiation levels have dissipated because the plume dissipates with time. So radiation levels around the plant are still very high, as you pointed out. But in the surrounding area, the plume has pretty much dissipated. But I would still be very cautious because the plume has radioactive elements that are water-soluble. Fission products, cesium, strontium, iodine, and it rained. And the rain will, in fact, like at Chernobyl, wash these radioactive products into the soil where it will get into foods. And so I think I would exercise more precaution than what is being done by the Japanese government and the officials there.
Michio, we're going to go to Japan right now to Sean Burney, who is a nuclear expert for Greenpeace International. Sean, can you tell us what the reaction right now is in Japan?
Well, certainly from the way the media are representing it and the individual citizens that they're interviewing around Tokaimura is one of growing shock and anger, maybe even disbelief at how the government once again managed to botch up an explanation as to what had happened and in terms of how they dealt with emergency procedures in the immediate hours after the accident. Generally being described as Japan's worst accident, images of children being checked for radiation, quite shocking images for a Japanese public that to some extent has sort of got used to the idea that it's a serious nuclear power.
Well, Sean, Burney, I was a reporter in Philadelphia during the Three Mile Island catastrophe, and the inability of even the press to get straight answers from government officials was amazing. Did the Japanese people get a sense immediately from the government or the press of what was happening, or was there also a huge delay there?
There was delays, as usual in Japan, in terms of communication. The Prime Minister's office was not informed for a number of hours. after the accident. In fact, there was no statement in terms of how serious this was for approximately 6 hours after the accident. Miscommunication as to what people should be doing, should they be in the street, should they be picking up their children from school. On one level, sort of understandable, given that they weren't terribly clear as to what was happening with the accident. But on another level, a real exposure of the total lack of any serious safety culture within the nuclear industry and the government and the regulatory authorities that are supposed to oversee it.
We're also joined on the telephone by Martin Forward, who's the campaign coordinator of Cumbrians Opposed to a Radioactive Environment, known as CORE, a group formed in 1980 by residents of Cambria in northwestern England, where Britain operates the massive Sutherfield nuclear plant. You know, Martin, when the media covers anything like this, it's often very much contained, like an egg, where we don't see the implications around the world or the nuclear cycle. Can you explain what you in northwestern England have to do with this nuclear accident in Japan?
Certainly. I mean, let me start by saying that the accident in Japan has received massive press coverage here in the UK. All the national papers are carrying it, all the television channels. And, of course, the significant interest for us in this part of the world, close to British nuclear fuel Sellafield plant, is the fact that Japan is a major customer for the British company. And all eyes in this part of the world are closely focused on what's going on in Japan today. And I have to say that what is coming across in the British media very, very clearly is an absolute amazement that an accident as basic as this can still be taking part in the global community, nuclear community today. Japan clearly is a technically advanced country, yet they have put themselves in the position of having an operating plant in which a risk of criticality is clearly very real.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll come back to Martin Forward, who's in northwestern England. We'll be joined by Sean Burney, who's with us from Japan, Greenpeace, and Dr. Michio Kaku in the studio with us in New York, physicist who has long been opposed to the use of nuclear power in this country and around the world. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, Juan Gonzalez in New York, as we talk about the nuclear accident that has shocked Japan as well as countries around the world. Workers accidentally setting off a nuclear fission chain reaction at a uranium processing plant about 75 miles northeast of Tokyo yesterday morning, sending three employees to the hospital, two in critical condition, exposing an unknown number of nearby residents residents to at least low levels of radiation. Officials asking more than 300,000 people in the surrounding area to remain in their homes. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask Michio Kaku now, what happens now? This town, Tokaimuro, as I understand it, has 34,000 people and 15 nuclear facilities in that small town. This plant is contaminated now. What's going to be the next steps for the Japanese government, and how long will it take to be able to make this plant safe again?
Okay, first of all, the cleanup will not be as extensive as at Chernobyl. At Chernobyl, we had about a ton of nuclear materials blown into the air, 80 million curies, a fantastic amount of radiation. Here we had most of the radiation confined to the site, but there was a plume. And the Livermore National Laboratory in the U.S. has now analyzed the direction of the plume, the amount of radiation, and how it will dissipate. So I think they're going to be able to contain, at least in the short term, the radiation there. They've gotten control of the site. It took them many hours to do this. The long-term fallout, though, is going to be enormous because, you see, Japan, unlike the United States, has opted for the hard nuclear option, the breeder reactor, the hardest of all nuclear options. Breeder reactor technology means you're going to use plutonium. You're going to start to use highly enriched uranium. This plant had about 19% enriched uranium. 90% is bomb-grade material. So Japan made the Faustian bargain. Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. And that's the Faustian bargain. Unlimited power, the power of uranium and plutonium. The only price is your soul.
I wanted to go to Sean Burney in Japan. Sean, right now we see this level of dependence on nuclear power in Japan. Why is that?
Very interesting question. Basically a policy drafted many, many years ago, insistence on the part of the policymakers in Japan that as a country, as an island nation dependent upon the importation of many of its raw resources, it had to be able to be self-sufficient. That's not a recent phenomenon. It goes back long before a post-war, pre-war period, obviously. In terms of why the industry remains so strong, industrial policy shifts very slowly. It doesn't change very quickly. In some respects, that's almost admirable, but when it comes to nukes, it certainly isn't. In terms of the non-civil side of nuclear power in Japan, basically, they have a plutonium program that is used as a strategic baton, basically, in East Asia. It basically sends a signal to Japan's neighbors that it has the option. That option can be used very rapidly, very quickly. It's no coincidence that the Science and Technology Agency, which was founded by Nakasone, one of the most aggressive right-wing prime ministers of the last half century in Japan, that Science and Technology Agency has two purposes. It develops ballistic missile technology under the guise of a space program, and it acquires large stocks of weapons-usable plutonium. It's a plausible deniability. It's able to say, we have a peaceful nuclear program, we need breeder reactor technology, we need reprocessing plants, we need enrichment facilities. That was set as Japanese policy over 30 years ago and remains Japanese policy. What that means in terms of being able to change is a much harder question to answer because the economics of nuclear power are becoming clearer. The utilities here are under greater competition due to deregulation, but the government and the bureaucracy are refusing to accept that the breeder is dead. There is, in fact, no breeder program in Japan of any worth. The Monju fast breeder reactor operated for 20 months before a massive sodium leak. Perhaps one of the most important points to be made, which makes this accident even more doubly tragic, was that the fuel being fabricated, as indicated by another colleague, was for the Joyo fast breeder reactor. Now, the Joyo fast breeder reactor was the experimental model, was a successor to Monju, but there is no breeder reactor program. In fact, they're switching to a higher enriched uranium fuel as opposed to plutonium fuel. They're not operating it as a breeder. So consequently, the workers that were affected by this, perhaps fatally affected by this accident, were being told to hurry along to produce fuel for a breeder reactor that will serve absolutely no future role in the provision of energy for this country. I think as that becomes to sink home to the Japanese public, that this is just a waste of lives and a contaminating incident as well, that the anger and outrage should build. Whether that will actually affect Japanese policy, however, is another matter.
I'd like to ask Martin Forward in England of the Cumbrians opposed to radioactive environment. What impact do you think this is going to have on nuclear policy in the European Union, given now that we've had three major accidents now in the past 20 years? Will this have any further effect on the policies there?
Oh, I think it will have considerable effect, yes. Clearly, some of the European community countries were considerably scaled down their nuclear programs as a result of the Chernobyl accident. I think today's accidents in Japan will simply reinforce the suspicions that this technology is in fact dangerous and should not be followed. And clearly in the case of the UK here, the nuclear power program is at the moment virtually on its last legs. So anything that happens anywhere else in the world has a major impact on us. And I would just point out, too, that, of course, there are major differences between the plants around the world. People do things a different way, a different system. We have here in the UK, for instance, the same kind of fabrication plant that has been involved in the accident in Japan, but they use a new system, a different system. But the fact remains that at the base of all this is human error, and humans are humans and will go on making these errors, irrespective of which country they're in. And the sad thing is that they will eventually affect us all. And, of course, sad as it may be that we have some deaths resulting from the Japanese accident, we should not forget also that there will be many other people in Japan around that plant who may in the future contract some form of cancer directly as a result of this accident. So there are the very long-term effects health-wise as well.
Martin Forward, can you explain the connection between your area in northwestern England and Japan? Talk about the massive Sellafield nuclear plant.
Sure. Sellafield is basically a reprocessing plant where they launder other people's reactor fuel, and a majority of the business for the newest of the reprocessing plants comes from overseas customers. Japan is the main customer, and then there are major customers in Europe as well. Now, the industry clearly says this is good business for them, but there are so many downsides to this operation, and I will just name a few. There are, of course, as a result of this laundry process, very significant discharges of radioactive material into our local environment, and, of course, it doesn't only stay local, because Sellafield's aerial discharges can be measured in your country, for instance, in Miami. And the sea discharges from Sellafield can be monitored around the coast of Canada, Greenland, and so on. So it is not just a local matter, but certainly radiation levels around the Sellafield plant in public accessible places are way above what we deem to be acceptable. That is the first downside. The second downside, of course, is the creation and accumulation of nuclear waste from reprocessing. It is an incredibly waste-productive system. You end up with very much more than you started with. And here in the UK, as in most other nuclear countries, there is no final disposal route for this waste. So we sit here in the northwest of England with a massive stockpile of this waste. And as we do with plutonium, which is also recovered from this reprocessing operation. And the immediate connection between Sellafield and Japan, of course, is the fact that as reprocessing customers, the Japanese industry has to take back the plutonium that is recovered here at Sellafield. Now, clearly, it is a very embarrassing thing for Japan to have to take back plutonium. They cannot stockpile the material. So the least embarrassing way for them to take it back is to take it back in this mixed oxide fuel form. The first shipment, which left Europe in July and has, I believe, just today arrived at Takahama. Now, there are all kinds of plutonium proliferation risks involved with shipping plutonium materials around the world, and it is that kind of nonsense that we are trying to stamp out. And if, sadly, the accident in Japan changes and diminishes the Japanese future nuclear policies, that will have a direct knock-on effect on us here in the UK, particularly for Sellafield, and that can only be for the good.
One final question for Michio Kaku. What do you think this is going to, what kind of impact will this have on nuclear policy in the United States? We're obviously going through the same battles about what to do with the residues of nuclear power. What's going to happen here?
Several things. First of all, the United States, under President Carter many years ago, canceled the breeder reactor program, thank God. But then President Clinton, through the back door, is trying to reintroduce the breeder reactor program because we have all this weapons-grade plutonium that we want to get rid of. We're talking about over 200 tons of plutonium left over from the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. And if we mix it with uranium, this is so-called mixed oxide fuel, or MOX, we're talking about building a new generation of breeder reactors. So at the present time, the Clinton administration is toying with the idea of reviving the breeder reactor program to burn plutonium that comes from the weapons plants. And we think it should be instead mixed with nuclear waste and plastics and glass and stuff so that it's unusable for bomb material rather than manufacturing this fuel, which will then be burned in breeder reactors, and the accident could happen all over again. So in the United States, we do have reprocessing centers, perhaps not as enriched as those in Japan, but we could have that kind of accident here in the U.S. as well. So this is a warning shot to the United States that we should not get into the breeder program and that we should stop the reprocessing of fuel because that involves chemical fires, explosions, and supercriticality accidents.
We want to thank you all very much for joining us. It's an issue, unfortunately, we're going to have to continue to cover with this latest news of the nuclear accident in Japan, the burst of radiation injuring plant workers, trapping 300,000 residents. Dr. Michio Kaku, nuclear physicist at City College, part of the City University of New York, author of the best-selling books Vision and Hyperspace. Sean Burney joining us from Japan, speaking for Greenpeace and International and Martin Forward of the campaign of Cumbrians opposed to radioactive environment core, which is based in Cambria in northwestern England. We have to go around the world because certainly the fallout of nuclear power does. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to another issue that faces countries around the world, President Clinton says poor nations shouldn't have to choose between making loan payments and vaccinating children. The president this week urged bankers and world finance chiefs to back a plan to forgive two-thirds of the debt owed by the world's poorest nations. Clinton calls it a gift to the new millennium and says without it, many of those nations will be condemned to perpetual poverty. The plan would offer debt relief to some $90 billion to 41 nations, most in Africa. Clinton has already asked Congress for $370 million, a down payment, he says, on the U.S. share. Well, to get reaction to President Clinton's words this week, we're joined by Njoki Jehu here in Washington, D.C. She's director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign, which just had its annual meeting, and also a member of the executive committee of Jubilee 2000. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
Njoki, what's your reaction to President Clinton's statement this week?
It's very encouraging. The Jubilee 2000 international movement and debt campaigns, some of them 10, 15 years old, have been calling for exactly this, for cancellation of the debts of the most impoverished countries. And Clinton is catching up with the call from Jubilee 2000, with the call from churches, the World Council of Churches, the All Africa Council of Churches, and civil society organizations around indebted countries in Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, as well as Asia. My one concern with Mr. Clinton's announcement announcement. He's still talking about forgiving debts. We are talking about cancellation. We are talking about this being a moral and justice issue, not a question of charity. Mr. Clinton has made an announcement which is significant. Now it is up to the U.S. Congress to appropriate the right amounts of money. It is up to U.S. Citizens and people listening around the country to make sure that their members of Congress, when the appropriation comes before them, do respond and do appropriate the right amount of money, and that in doing this, they do not do it in a way or with conditions that continue to demand that countries adhere to structural adjustment programs, because this is a self-defeating and self-perpetuating problem if the debt cancellation is linked to structural adjustment programs.
Njoki, I'd like to ask you, I know Ecuador recently, over the weekend, created a stir by saying that it would not be able to meet some of its debt payments. I don't know if our listeners have a real understanding of how onerous this debt situation is. I know some governments in Latin America, a third or a fourth of their national budget goes to pay their national debt. Could you give us a sense of what, among some of the poorest countries, how significant the debt problem is?
Yes, I can give you some examples. In a place like Tanzania, where the life expectancy has continued to fall and where 40% of the population dies before the age of, before the age of 35, the government is spending 9 times more on debt servicing than on health and education combined. In Nicaragua, you hear people saying that during the times of the war and of the embargo, they had more food and they had more hope compared to now with the debt and with the imposition of structural adjustment programs. When you look around Africa and the AIDS crisis, countries are spending, Zambia is spending $17 on health, on the health of each person, while spending about $30 per person on servicing the debt. And these are all countries that have massive, massive needs in education as well, and in food security. Credit to women farmers has fallen. The infant mortality has risen. All of those are connected to the issue of the countries first prioritizing servicing the debt, then providing meeting the basic needs of their citizens. So Ecuador is not alone. And part of what the World Bank and the IMF are doing with the HEPIC initiative, part of what the Cologne initiative that was agreed to, that was put forward in June at the G7 meetings and agreed to this weekend at the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF is doing, is to keep the countries that are just about to fall off, like Ecuador, can no longer make the payments, put them on a treadmill so that they are able to continue to service the debt.
Very interesting to be here in Washington as these World Bank and IMF meetings have taken place, and also watching this new nation, East Timor, about to come into being. One of the first meetings of the leader of Timor, Xanana Gusmão, was at the World Bank. And the question is, can countries direct their own development if they take any kind of World Bank IMF money, and should they take it at all?
The answer is I don't think that they can, because those monies come with a lot of conditions. And East Timor perhaps has a unique opportunity like Eritrea did, where they're coming into being, a new nation is being born, and they don't have the debt. And in the case of Eritrea, in fact, there were reports that the World Bank wanted to get them to take a huge loan to repair the railway system. And the nation of Eritrea said, wait a minute, let's look at this. And instead of getting $250 million loan to do this, what they did was they revived all these former engineers and builders of the railway system who had retired and took a smaller loan. And instead of getting architects and experts from the West and from the North, they did it themselves. And I think East Timor would do well to look at this example from Eritrea and to think about ways in in which that there is development and addressing of issues from the priorities of ordinary people versus from the priorities of the World Bank and the IMF.
Jyoti Jehu, we want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to get more information on Jubilee 2000, where can they go on the web or call?
There's a website, www.j2000usa.org. Also, the 50 Years is Enough website, www.50years.org.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and Jyoti Jehu, who is director of 50 Years is Enough and on the executive committee of the Jubilee 2000 campaign. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After stations identify themselves, we'll come back to look at this week of extradition hearings in the case of General Augusto Pinochet. Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, Juan Gonzalez in New York. A human rights lawyer seeking to bring former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet to trial in Spain yesterday denounced the courtroom tactics of Pinochet's defense team, likening it to the twisted logic of the Spanish Inquisition. Spanish attorney Juan Garces, who represents the families of the victims of Chile's dirty war and was announced the winner of Sweden's alternative Nobel Peace Prize yesterday, accused Pinochet's lawyers of inventing arguments aimed at convincing London magistrate Bartle to free the 83-year-old general. Pinochet's extradition hearing ended yesterday in London, a ruling expected in the next few weeks. Bartle headed the 91 investigation into police misconduct in the case of the Guildford Four, the four young Irish people who were convicted of the bombing in London on basis of information fabricated by the police, but shelved the inquiry after concluding that police routinely had to engage in similar behavior. He's also said police are doing the work of God, in a book he wrote. But joining us right now from London, Reid Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, who's been giving us an almost daily update from the Bow Street Magistrates Court on the proceedings. Welcome, Juan. Can you tell us what happened in the last day of the extradition proceedings in the case of General Augusto Pinochet?
Well, the last day was really devoted to closing arguments. The magistrate, Ronald Bartle, who you mentioned, said that he would be making his ruling next Friday, October 8th at 11 o'clock. General Pinochet normally will have to appear in court when Bartle hands down his decision, although it's expected that his lawyers will seek to excuse him for medical reasons. Essentially, this should be an open and shut case. All Spain has to do to warrant General Pinochet's extraditions is prove that the facts that he's alleged to have, the allegations, allege facts which constitute crimes in both Spain and the UK. The Crown representing Spain was not required to show that General Pinochet is actually guilty. They were just required to show that the allegations of torture and conspiracy to torture were properly made out. Pinochet, as you know, raised arguments that Spain had no jurisdiction because there were no Spanish citizens, that some of the acts committed by Pinochet didn't rise to the level of torture, that the prosecution couldn't introduce new allegations, new cases of torture that had come to that had been included in the case after the House of Lords made its decision. But I really don't think any of those arguments are going to hold water. with the court.
Well, we're also joined by phone from England by Gareth Pierce, who was an attorney who represented the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, and who has had direct experience with the judge in this case, Judge Bartle. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gareth Pierce.
Hello.
And could you tell us a little bit about this judge and how he has functioned in past cases?
We have a very restricted venue for extradition in the United Kingdom. All extradition cases are dealt with at one court in London, London only, which it itself achieves a certain amount of injustice if people are detained for extradition, say, from Northern Ireland or Scotland, then they're obliged to be dealt with in London. And what that means is that there are very few magistrates in the country entitled to deal with extradition, of whom one of those few is Mr. Bartle, and he has a history of surprising decisions and is certainly viewed by defence lawyers with a great deal of scepticism as to his attitudes, in particular because he has committed some of those attitudes to print and has, for instance, endorsed the testimony of police officers indicating that they are specially trained to observe and consequently are likely to be more impressive witnesses than other witnesses. All of this means that he is assumed to come to hearings with a loaded agenda of his own, and lawyers would want to be alert to his preconceptions.
In terms of his history, though, very briefly, before we go on to our next guest, Gareth Pierce, can you tell us what his previous rulings have been when it relates to police conduct?
The one that attracted the most attention was when officers who clearly, on absolutely overwhelming evidence, had fabricated interview records which had led to the wrongful imprisonment of four young people for 15 years, the Guildford Four as they're known. And he took a decision to stop, to stay the proceedings against them on the basis that they were suffering from, would suffer from the adverse publicity that had been brought about by the freeing of those four. And the delay in bringing proceedings against them. I think in doing that, he had probably given the kind of weight that ought to be given to prejudicial prosecutions, but that isn't given to defendants other than police officers. And so that, combined with his writings and other rulings that he's made over the years, simply endorsed the view that if it was police in the dock, they would get one form of treatment. If it was ordinary defendants in the dock, they would get another. And that's a very unfortunate slant for a magistrate to be so clearly giving by his actions.
Amy, one of the arguments that was made by Pinochet's lawyers before Magistrate Bartle was they referred to the case of one victim who died after being given electric shocks, and Pinochet's lawyers argued that this was not torture. Well, we're joined in the studio here at BAI by Ernesto Castillo, a Chilean exile who was imprisoned and tortured during the Pinochet regime. I'd like to ask him what his reaction is to this argument in the British court.
Well, my first reaction is outrage and anger at this attempt by the Pinochet defense to present this the statement they made. And it's no doubt in my mind that if there's any decency and the British courts and the British person who is who had to make the decision on this case, that the verdict has to be guilty, which is the verdict that's been casted by the international community already. Pinochet's guilty, and all those who follow his command are guilty too. This has been proven in so many years of documented cases of torture and murder and disappearances of political opponents. I was subjected to the treatment of the secret police, of the Chilean secret police, and I know by first hand what torture is. And that is days and weeks of isolation, electric shocks, beating, being blindfolded, folded with a hood, and subjected to many other types of torture that eating excrement and drinking urine and et cetera. So it's ridiculous to think that in 1988, all of a sudden the Chilean secret police start doing this. This is a precedent that was continuing for many, many, many years until Pinochet left, was forced to leave. So I think it's a ridiculous argument. And as I said before, if there's any decency and this judge who's going to make a decision, it's no doubt in my mind that this decision has to be guilty and cannot be any other way.
Which actually brings us back to this point for people who may be confused what exactly Pinochet is being charged with if he were extradited to Spain. Reed Brody, maybe you can clarify this, as Ernesto Castillo talks about being tortured before 1988, yet these cases come only after 1988. Why?
Sure. The charges being brought in Spain against General Pinochet are quite wide-ranging. They include terrorism. They include thousands of cases of torture and political killings and disappearances. When Pinochet was arrested, he appealed to the British courts and said, "You can't arrest me. I have immunity because I was a former head of state." In two decisions, in the second decision of the British House of Lords, the highest court in Britain, they ruled that Pinochet, in fact, historically Pinochet would have enjoyed immunity, but that immunity was overridden by the International Convention Against Torture, which has been ratified by Chile, England, the United Kingdom, and Spain. But that only applied as of 1988, when the ratifications became effective. So Pinochet could only be extradited to Spain. He could only be arrested in the UK. His immunity was only defeated after 1988, when that torture convention became effective. So now the only charges left in the case are tortures that were committed after 1988, as well as, very importantly, as conspiracy to commit torture, which I think is in fact the charge that goes to the heart of the case, because it alleges that Pinochet used torture as a weapon of intimidation and political persecution. It's a charge that will allow the prosecutors eventually, if the case gets to Spain, to show that Pinochet created a framework that relied on torture, that he was aware that torture was being practiced systematically, and that he never once punished anyone who had committed torture. But it is no longer open, because of the House of Lords decision, it is no longer open for the prosecutors to prove and to condemn Pinochet for each and every torture that was committed before December 1988.
Well, Amy, we're also joined on the phone from Barcelona, Spain, by Fabiola Letelier, the daughter of Orlando Letelier, former defense minister of Chile, whose assassination by a car bomb in Washington was linked to Pinochet's secret police. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you very much. But I would like to clarify, I am not the daughter of Orlando Letelier. I am the sister of Orlando Letelier.
That, excuse me for that, yes.
I, as a lawyer and as a victim, I started in Chile the process that lasted 15 years till we obtained the condemned sentence for Contreras and Espinosa. So this is the role that I have played as a lawyer before the Chilean tribunals.
And what is your reaction to the proceedings so far in London and your expectation about the upcoming decision?
I am really very optimistic. I believe that the verdict will be the extradition of Pinochet to Madrid. This will be the recognition of the law, of the right, because Pinochet is an international criminal. He not only committed violence and a violation of human rights inside of Chile, he also committed international actions out of our country. And one is the case of my brother, Orlando Letelier, that was attacked with international action in Washington, D.C., the 21st of September, 1976. And in this international action, one American girl, Ronnie Carmen Moffitt, was also dead.
Well, we want to thank you all very much for being with us. This is a case, as you can see, we take very seriously as dictators, murderers, assassins do around the world, afraid sometimes to leave their countries. I understand Suharto in Indonesia is afraid to leave for medical treatment. I also understand Henry Kissinger checks with the State Department to know if there's any developments before he leaves this country, not wanting to be in the same situation as Augusto Pinochet in England. But we will continue to cover this case. Thank you to Reed Brody, Fabiola Letelier, Ernesto Castillo, and Gareth Pierce. That does it for the show today. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Donna Neiman. Our engineer in New York, Matthew Finch. In Washington, Joe Gill. I look forward to meeting the listeners of KDUR. I'm coming out to Durango today to speak at Fort Lewis College tonight. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!